Life expectancy content is for informational and storytelling purposes only. We are not medical professionals, and nothing discussed in this episode or contained on the life expectancy website should be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you're facing medical concerns, addiction, or any health-related challenges, please seek guidance from a qualified medical professional or a licensed healthcare provider. Thank you for being a part of our journey, and we encourage you to seek support from trusted professionals when needed. Hi, everybody. It's Julie and Stacy with Life Expectancy.
Hi, Stacy here.
We are coming to you between seasons because we did something really cool and we want to talk about it.
University of Cincinnati, where I received my liver, has an annual transplant picnic for liver recipients.
So we had never been to it before, but they do this every year, I believe. They do a lot of other things too throughout the whole year, helping this community to stay together and to continue to interact with each other. Quite a few of the people that attended the picnic are also ambassadors for the hospital that come and talk to people as they're getting ready for transplant or just after they've received transplant.
This was an opportunity with a lot of like-minded people to visit with and explain what we're all about. And so we got shirts and stickers and water bottles.
I was a little bit nervous, maybe for different reasons than you were or would be.
Yeah, I was nervous.
But I was nervous about what was it going to be like to be in a space with people who you don't have to explain what it feels like to go through what we did. Every single person in this space knew what we are talking about.
In one way or another, each of them went through exactly what I went through. It's one thing to interact with these group of people on the private Facebook group, but it's another to actually see them in real life. I mean, it was really emotional for me. Every person that I looked at there, I felt so accepted. I felt so understood. There are so many things, even with you standing right next to me, that I still can't fully put into words. Those people went through it exactly like me. They had to deal with all the staples through their torso. They had to learn how to breathe again, grow muscles again. They had the ERCPs, which I hate. They went through the diagnostics. They jumped through the hoops. I didn't fully expect that. I was nervous of how I would measure up to all these people who had been through the same thing I had been through.
It's a shared experience. It's so nice to be in a group of people where you don't, there's certain things you just don't have to say. You're just already connected on a level. I was nervous because we show up as a health advocate. It was for friends and family also. I didn't know how many other health advocates would be there. And I ran into one of the coordinators. And it was just so nice that people were happy to see us, put the name with the face, like you said, from that private group. But also, they were genuinely happy for us to share our story. And they wanted to be a part of what we were doing.
The excitement was palpable. I would have never expected that kind of reception from a shared community that we belong to. And they were on board and excited to hear my journey, to share their journeys.
Yeah.
I felt so like a warm embrace. That's the best way I can describe it.
So I talked my sister into allowing us to bring some recording equipment, not because I expected people necessarily to want to talk to us, but I wanted to ask. And I know she was really hesitant, and I want to address something about that. So when you build a community and you're doing something, you want to share that something. And so I also want to know, what do they do for a living and how are they contributing to society? And then I want to contribute to that. It's kind of this silly idea. If I can listen to any podcast, if I can buy a house from any realtor, if I can support somebody on a YouTube channel, I feel like it's another way to give back to our community is to look at what people that have been through similar things are doing. And that's not to exclude anybody else, but it's just one of those things where I sort of feel like you're already going to do that thing. So what if I could find somebody in our community to do that thing with? And I felt that there. And so anyway, we set up the recording equipment. And why I bring that up is Stacey was like, I don't want people to feel pressured, and I don't want them to feel like we're trying to exploit this experience, which we were not.
Exploit. That's exactly the word I was just going to say. I felt like, okay, well, this is the first time we're coming and we're already going to make a splash wearing our matching shirts with our water bottles and our stickers. And what if they do think we're trying to capitalize off something like this?
Yeah.
And that's not what we're about at all. More than anything, we just want to make this just a little bit easier for the next person that goes through it, a little bit easier for the next healthcare advocate that stands next to their transplant recipient, just a little bit easier. And so I think through sharing our journey, through sharing our stories, and they have a common thread, but they are all different.
Yeah.
I think that's beneficial to anybody who could be going through this. And I was afraid that if we brought recording equipment, that maybe just people wouldn't understand.
But that isn't what happened.
That's not what happened.
And it was amazing. So I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm asking people, hey, would you like to come and talk to me? And oh my gosh. So we got so many great interviews that day and a list of people that want to come in studio.
More than we could record.
Yeah. That want to come in studio and record with us.
It was, there's no other word to say, but awesome. It was awesome sitting there interviewing people like Dale or Sherry, my most hated procedures in ERCP. And Sherry right away was like, oh my God, I hate those. And I know that she went through exactly what I went through.
Yeah.
We just had so much in common when talking to these people, yet their stories are different from mine.
They are. And how they got to needing a liver transplant is often very different. But I will tell you one really cool thing that happened, and then we're going to talk a little bit about each of the people. During this episode, we're going to share with you little snippets of the interviews that we took of each of these individuals. But Julie was at the picnic, and I was so excited. And she has now received her second liver transplant.
Yes, she went through full rejection.
Yep. And she is willing to come and talk to us. So it's a really cool connection beyond even this group with
her. I never thought I'd see her again.
Right.
And when we were getting ready to take the picture of everybody, because we took a picture of everybody there, and I passed her and I said, hey, I'm sure you don't remember me, but you were the first person I saw post-transplant who was healthy and looked like they had a life. You showed me your scars, and they were healed in a way I never thought mine would. And you gave me such inspiration that day. And it was just a brief 30-second encounter between the two of us at the picnic, and then we all got together for the picture. But a lot of those times, you don't get to go back and honor what that person meant to you, because she might have just been doing her job. She might have not really realized the impact she made on me, that 4 years, almost 5 years post-transplant, she is still someone I think about that gave me hope that I could recover and have a life and make the most out of this special gift.
You know, there was a lot of experiences like that day. So we didn't get to interview Julie that day, but we will. She'll be in season two, I hope. But at some point, she'll come in studio. So the very first person that I was able to talk to, we hit the jackpot. So Don was the first guy that came over. And his partner was really cute because she was like, well, how much time do you have? He's a talker. But it is so amazing. In this interview, what you're going to hear is a person who has gone on to give back to this community in a huge way on the national stage. So he's connected in many different ways to supporting and advocating for the liver transplant community. Wealth of knowledge. It was so great to talk to somebody who had so much medical knowledge.
He was very connected. I talked to him off mic, and he was very knowledgeable, straightforward. And as we were talking, other people were joining us and coming in and out of the conversation. It was,
You know, something else that he mentions that I think is really important, that I hope to dive a little bit deeper with him, because he said he was willing to come into studio for season two, was he was talking about, it doesn't matter how you got there. It doesn't matter how you got to the place where you need a liver. At that point, your experience is exactly the same. in terms of need. So in talking to Don, he had a great example of something that happened to him individually that became something that was helpful for everyone. So after his, he was telling me about after his liver transplant, within a certain number of hours, he was having an allergic reaction to one of the required medications that you need in order to not reject your liver. So one of those anti-rejection medications. But it was a terrible experience. He ended up, I think, back in surgery.
Of course, probably.
Like within a very short period of time. But what's really interesting is that that reaction that he had is now something they look for. It's very rare for people to be allergic, but now they know what it looks like. So what's cool about this interview, and I hope to talk to him longer, is that it's another example of something that happened to him individually that has long-term benefit for the entire community. Mm-hmm. So let's listen a little bit to my interview with Don. I am here at the UC Liver Transplant Picnic 2025, and I am with Don Melillo.
That's right.
Don is a liver transplant recipient of 2012, which is quite a long time ago.
It'll be 13 years October, October 12th, actually.
Is amazing. He's also very involved in helping people stay connected. So we'll talk a little bit about the support group that he put together and runs. So Don, take it away.
My journey, I really started in 2011, having a lot of stomach problems and issues. And finally, my GI doctor said, I'm going to talk to a few other doctors and see if I can figure out what's wrong with you. He goes, I've run every test possible and ruled out anything with cancer or whatever. And so he talked to a few doctors. Next thing I know, I was on my way to UC Health, and they found that I had cancer of the liver. They told me my only option was to have a transplant. I was relieved they finally found out what was wrong with me, although I didn't like the outcome.
Of course.
As anyone that has had a transplant will tell you, being told you're going to have a transplant is a scary moment. And all kinds of thoughts go through your mind. And
I don't know that scary quite covers it. I think it's terrifying.
Well, it is. The liver is a remarkable organ, and I could go on forever about the liver because of everything I've learned about it. But in myself, I was scared to death. And my wife and I had the conversation afterwards that she doesn't know how many nights I went to bed with tears in my eyes, wondering if I'd wake up.
Yep.
And as she told me, that I don't know how many nights she was calling her best friend with tears, wondering if I would wake up. So,
yeah.
But it's a scary time, and you don't know. The worst part of any transplant is the wait time.
Yeah.
Because the sicker you are, the better off you are, because it moves you up on the list. But that also means, as many transplant people will tell you, that, yeah, the closer to death you are, the better off you are, and it's very true. I mean, my surgeon told my wife following my surgery that I wouldn't have been around for another 2 weeks had he not performed the surgery when he did. So I got my call and went down to the hospital and waited for my transplant. I also had a lot of complications with my transplant. One of the things, our bodies don't like anything that's not our own. So our organs that we receive in transplant, our bodies don't like. So we take medication to take care of that. Basically take a pill that runs our immune system down, but they can't leave it down so far, so we take another pill that brings it back up. I was allergic to the number one anti-rejection medicine they give transplant patients.
Is that Tacro or Envarsus?
Tacro,
yeah.
And I'm allergic to Tac, and it took University of Cincinnati Hospital over 2 weeks to figure that out. They thought I had a brain aneurysm. They weren't sure what was wrong.
Man.
Running me through tests, trying to figure out why it was so crazy.
I don't think that's very common either. So it's an anti-rejection medication. Yeah. So
I was told at the time only about 1% of the population.
I was going to say it's got to be really small.
Being allergic to that, I also was losing blood almost quicker than they could put it into me. Ended up back into surgery that evening. And our surgeon told my wife, Cindy, that don't worry, I'll go home and I'll call you. And she got a call about 2 that morning saying everything was good and they take care of that. But I still, they hadn't found out because it was really just the next day that they sent me back into surgery. My goal was to get out in 3 days because I was told that transplant patients usually get out 5 to 7. And I wanted to break that. Well, 28 days later, I got out.
Yeah.
And I didn't break the record of getting out. I almost broke the record of staying in. But a lady came into the hospital, started to have some of the same symptoms and
they caught
problems,
it?
And they caught it.
Okay.
So right away they took her off tack. And a couple of months following surgery, my transplant doctor asked me, he goes, would you come back? Because they used to have a class for all of the transplant patients.
Yeah.
And so I went to the class, and he goes, would you speak to the patients? And so I used to go back every month and speak to the transplant patients. And it was very rewarding to walk in and say, okay, I'm only a year out or a few months out, and I'm here to talk to you. There is life after transplant. People would come up to me in the class, and they still do, to say, let me give you a hug. I, you know, just what I needed today. Following my transplant, because of all my problems, I got very involved with the Donate Life organization. With our, we started a support group.
Well, so this is a perfect segue, because I was going to say, all right, Don, tell me about your work now and what you started this UC liver transplant support group.
Well, I didn't start it. The social workers at UC Transplant started it. But when COVID hit, the support group couldn't meet in person. And so I started doing a Zoom meeting to keep us together. Mm-hmm. And we're really the only active support group going on at UC today. You know, but I started to give back, and then I got involved with American Liver Foundation, and I'm very active with them, and I go down once a week and visit patients in the hospital and talk to them about transplant when they get home, what they need to do, what they need to think about. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't realize that there's over 100 diseases of the liver. And there's one stigma with liver disease, and that's alcohol.
And that's what we're dealing with.
It's only, as I say to patients that tell me, okay, I'm here because of drugs or alcohol, I always tell them that's only one of the diseases, and they've conquered that disease, and they're listening to their doctors and nurses, and they've accomplished that. So, but it's also a doctor at our liver walk a couple of years ago said liver disease is the silent disease.
Yeah.
People don't know they have it, and when they have it, they don't talk about it.
Right.
And I'm not one to shy away from talking about liver disease. I will give back to the day I pass away to help other people understand what I went through and help them on their journey with this disease.
Dale was this guy walking around with his wife, had a smile on his face.
Red t-shirts.
Yeah, they were wearing matching shirts too. Well, Dale, he won the prize on the person that had been there at the picnic with the longest transplant.
Yep.
And he received his transplant, I think it was like 88 or 89, which is like a billion years ago.
Yeah.
And I am just giddy. I am excited to talk to him. There is so much hope and love I had for this gentleman. I think I overwhelmed him. I don't know. I was just so excited to hear from him, because seeing someone that got this many years out of a transplant and getting it so long ago.
Right. Medicine was different. So many things were different.
Blew my mind.
So anyway, let's play a little bit of Dale, and you'll get to hear more, hopefully, from him in the future. Dale is here with us, Dale Mertz, and we've asked him to come talk to us because he is a liver transplant recipient from 1988.
Which is crazy, crazy, and brings me so much hope and inspiration.
So Dale, tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I'll tell you what, I started out when I was 19 years old. I just graduated from high school at 18, but I made it to 19, and I came down with diarrhea. And I tell you what, I knew where every bathroom in the city was. I mean, it was
bad. And that is definitely one of the side effects of liver disease, for sure.
Yeah, it was bad. And basically, it came to a point where I lost my large intestine when I was 25 because of ulcerative colitis.
Wow.
During the years after that, I lost my large intestine. Then I had my transplant when I was 31. It was a 16.5-hour surgery.
Oh, that's crazy. I think mine was, what, 11?
Something like that.
11 or 12.
16 hours, that's, wow.
Yeah, 16.5 hours long. And basically, it took out my large intestine. I was 25. And during my liver transplant, I lost my gallbladder and my spleen.
And the spleen. They took my gallbladder.
Yeah. So
1988, that was back in the day.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That was quite a lot to deal with for a young person, I would say. You know, 19?
I was 19. I had five little kids.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, not when I was 19, but when I had my liver transplant when I was 30.
Okay, let's clarify. So when he was 19 was when he realized that something was going on.
Right.
And then he received his liver transplant at 31. And at that point, between 19 and 31, you had 5 little kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Not at 19.
No.
Dale has lived the life.
And actually, I remember that he told me I had needed a liver transplant. 2 days later, I got my liver.
2 days?
Yes.
Wow.
I remember my wife brought my 5 little kids up. They put them on my bed, and they rolled me down the hallway. And aww. I could just see the nurses looking at me and said, he's not coming back.
It is amazing to see you, and you bring me so much hope and inspiration, and you look so healthy and so positive. I love it.
Because people are listening to us, they can't see you. I just want to describe your spirit. Just, it precedes him in the room.
Well, them 5 little kids that I was on the bed with, they gave me all the inspiration I needed.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, Dale, are you still working? Are you retired?
Actually, I just retired, right before COVID.
Congratulations.
So 2020.
Tell us a little bit about your life now.
Okay, well, I started a new hobby.
What's your new hobby?
I'm into CNC.
CNC.
It tells my router what to do. And I'm teaching myself
woodworking.
I'm teaching myself computers now.
Well, that's amazing. I love that.
Construction all my life. Now I'm into computers.
Just to let you know, I just can't stop gushing. You just give me so much hope.
I try to help out any way I can.
I was able to interview Matt Dill, who was probably the newest liver transplant. He just received it on Boxing Day in December. And talking to him, he and I felt like had such a genuine connection. I mean, there was a point where I was really struggling to keep it together.
I could see the connection you guys formed so quickly.
I think it's because he was so open and he was so raw and he was so honest. And he was speaking directly to what you and I have talked about, and it was so fresh, right? He was the keynote speaker for the Donate Life walk, but that was really amazing and tough and also so inspiring to hear his story. I am here with Matt at the UC Liver Picnic. Received his liver transplant in December of 2024, so a newbie. So tell me a little bit about you, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much. So my name is Matt Dill, and I am 37 years old, and I was diagnosed of end-stage liver disease May of 2024, and they gave me a year to live, and when I got that news, I decided to kind of make a change, and I started eating healthy, I started exercising, and when I got that diagnosis, I was 230 pounds. So I started walking, you know, maybe 10, 20 minutes a day, and I got up to 30 minutes, then 40 minutes, then, you know, basically I was walking an hour or two a day.
Yeah.
And things were going great, and I actually lost about 60, 70 pounds over that summer of last year. And then October came, and I started to feel really bad. And we kind of knew this was coming. I started feeling weaker, and, you know, I would walk in the mornings and the afternoons. The mornings was super early, so it was in the dark, and there'd be, like, a few potholes, and a few times I stepped in one, and I would go to catch myself, but my legs were so weak that I couldn't.
Yeah.
So around October 31st of last year, I decided that I was going to stop walking because it just wasn't healthy. Things progressively got worse. I couldn't walk 10 feet without, like, holding on to the wall.
Mm.
Actually, one of the worst days was I had to get my wisdom teeth out before the surgery.
Yeah. People don't realize often that you have to get checked out all the way, including dentistry, to make sure that you're a good candidate for the surgery. To get on the list, you have to do a lot of those things. And so if there's anything that could be detrimental to either going under or your survival after, then they need to take care of it before.
Yeah, and the way I thought of it as, God, wouldn't it be awful if I got this transplant and then my mouth got infected afterwards?
Right.
That would certainly be a painful way to go. I was happily ready to do it, and I almost saw the wisdom teeth as kind of a prep for the surgery.
Yeah, no,
I hadn't had any, you know, really major medical thing ever happen to me in my life. And I thought up until that point, I was lucky that I didn't even get my wisdom teeth out. You know, I hadn't been to a doctor in 10 years, which was also part of the problem, by the way.
Right.
So one of the worst days was walking in to get that done. they had to wheelchair me in for a dental surgery.
Right.
So I knew for years that something was wrong with me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was the typical male, stubborn.
Yep.
You know.
What you don't know, don't want to know.
Exactly. You know, everybody fears going to that,
sure.
that doctor's appointment. And unfortunately, I did have something to fear. But yeah, so things progressed. Dental surgery went fine. You know, I went home and I recovered from that. I was still working at the time. And then maybe people aren't aware, but when your liver starts to fail, you start having fluid buildup.
Yep.
So one time I was feeling extremely bad. They told me that I would need to get paracentesis.
Yeah.
Well, it almost felt like I was about to explode, honestly.
Yeah.
I looked pregnant. So I went to the emergency room in extreme pain, couldn't walk very well. Then they did an emergency paracentesis in the emergency department, which in the emergency department, they bring out the ultrasound, they look inside you, and then they just go.
Yeah, they just go. Yeah.
So that was kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
But after they drained me, you know, this is 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And I felt much better. And then about 3 weeks later, we noticed that it had to get done again. So I actually had a scheduled one. But after we broke the seal on that first one, then it became every week.
Yeah.
And it became, you know, every 4 days. And then I would have to, like, plan my weekends. I'd have to get it done on Friday, or I knew I was going in for an emergency one on Sunday. Eventually, I was 2 or 3 days.
Totally sucks.
Yeah. And I knew the radiology girls, they knew I was coming every single week. And when I wouldn't go, they'd either think, great, Matt got the transplant, or the opposite.
He passed. Yeah.
So.
That's rough, man.
Yeah. Okay. A few times they noticed my sodium level was extremely low because they would take blood every time too. And my hemoglobin was extremely low. And eventually they would start admitting me after that.
Yeah.
So I would have
stints of being admitted, yeah.
Those stints, I had a few that were like six days or something like that. But I would go home and eventually get to stay at home. And then I qualified for the list on December 5th.
Nice.
Which is great. And, you know, that's kind of terrifying in itself.
It is. That was a big turning point for us when I needed her to get on that list. She was denied several times.
Oh, my God.
So we finally got her on.
Yeah.
I remember that feeling.
Okay, so December 5th, I qualified for the list, and they tell you it could be any time.
Yeah.
And so they said, we'll be calling you. And sure enough, 24 hours later, they called.
24 hours.
Yes.
We were 6 days.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really fast.
Right.
So 24 hours.
24 hours. And they said, now go ahead and just get some sleep because we're going to bring you in tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Good luck with that. Sleep is impossible.
Yeah, no way.
So I'm sitting on my couch at 7 a.m. the next day, ready to go, waiting for this call because they said we would call. The same lady who called the night before, I believe, called, and she was really chipper the night before. Well, the next morning,
Not so chipper.
I could hear her voice. That it wasn't going to happen. That was frustrating. But you had to go on and just live life. I mean, it wasn't the right one for me. So yeah, 7, 10 days go by, and I was having one of those stints where I was just feeling terrible again. It felt extremely bad. And we called the transplant team, and we basically said, look, I feel absolutely terrible. All right, we'll come downtown. So we came downtown. Oh, on the way downtown, I get a call at 10 p.m., it's the same chipper woman. And she goes, we have an offer for you. And I'm like, oh, fantastic. Good. I'll be there in 5 minutes, basically.
Because you were already on your way there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And we went through the night. We stabilized me. Did a bunch, you know, obviously the pre-tests and everything.
Sure.
They told me that there would be one more person to come down to sign with an iPad.
Yeah.
For, like, the final signatures. And then, like, an hour later, a doctor walks in. And he didn't have an iPad in his hand.
Mm. So number two.
Yeah. And I lost it.
Yeah, sure. Of course. It's devastating.
Right.
Oh, man. Just breathe. It's okay. Just take a breath.
So we spent another 4 or 5 hours in there. I mean, they had stabilized me, and I wanted to go home.
Yeah.
So eventually, I would say this is like December 15th, 16th by now, and they just sent us home and went back to the normal paracentesis.
Yeah, which sucked.
Yeah.
It's terrible. I mean, at that point, we had those moments where, I'm going to try not to cry, but we had those moments where you're asking yourself, is this really what she wants to do? And I don't know if you had any of those.
there wasn't any giving up, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful.
I mean, I'd adopted 100% positivity besides when these things happen.
Well,
I mean,
sure. You have to have your feelings to process things.
So then it went a few more days, probably a week. You know, Christmas came, and then the morning of December 26th, finally I get the call that says, okay, come on down. You know, people talk about that day, like your life flashing before your eyes. I feel like I was the most calm that day for some reason.
Yeah.
So that day somehow went the greatest it could have.
Yeah.
And I do find solace in the fact that those two beforehand, even though they didn't work out and they were a struggle, I mean, it was for the best.
Sure.
I got the absolute best possible, and I can't thank my doctors, my nurses especially. You know, those people were amazing. And I woke up on the morning of December 27th, and what's cool is I actually have a video of when they were walking in, the first time I talked to the surgeons. And, I mean, you can hear the gratitude in my voice. You can hear I'm like repeating thank you a thousand times. But one of the greatest things that stood out to me was there was this nurse named Tracy, and I said, yeah, thank you. You guys did a great job. And she just cuts me off, and she basically bluntly says, well, we did our job. It's your job now.
Yeah.
That was super cool because, I mean, it clicked in my head then, too, and you could hear my voice kind of change, but it's 100% the truth. The biggest thing was just the unknown, and that's the biggest fear we all can have, really. But it turns out it was fine. And if anybody who's listening to this that's pre-op, it's going to be scary. It's going to be tough. It's going to be a long road. My suggestion is just keep moving, because I know when I stood still and I sat there, and almost the pain was worse. Obviously, we all have limits. So don't push it too hard. But just get up and move, because you survived this for a reason. Moving is what you need to do to move on.
Another interview that I was really excited to get. She's so involved with so many things. She was actually coordinating and she was running the picnic. She's also been on the news and she's been a huge face for a liver transplant and Donate Life.
University of Cincinnati, Donate Life, definitely.
And I think she's also going to be an ambassador, which is really cool. Anyway, Stacey was able to sit down with Sherry, and Sherry has her own YouTube channel called Tacro Fueled. Tacro as in tacrolimus, so T-A-C-R-O Fueled. Go look it up. Check it out. So tell us a little bit about your interview with Sherry.
It was a little intimidating, actually, because, like I said, she is very prominent in the community, and she's well-known. She's a big organizer. She's a big personality. Everybody loves her. But she has a lot of energy and enthusiasm and is a real great addition to the liver transplant community, because she is an advocate for Donate Life, and she's really great about spreading the word. And she had a lot of good information to share as well.
You could feel her from across the room in such a great way. So let's hear a little bit of your interview with Sherry, and we'll do more in season two.
I am joined by Sherry Patterson.
Hello, hello.
Everybody knows Sherry. She's known for her hair. We recognize you everywhere.
Blue hair.
Tell us a little bit about your story.
So I got super sick with liver disease in 2019 and really didn't know what was going on. Just knew that I was sick. So I was diagnosed with stage 4 and devastated. Then I started losing my faculties. I had hepatic encephalopathy really bad. I didn't know anybody, didn't recognize people, don't remember much still. It was pretty rough. I ended up at a transplant center and was on the waiting list for 2.5 years.
Wow.
Ended up being in hospice care.
Do you remember your MELD score?
My MELD score was 34. And
gosh, so you were really sick.
It ended up that my body was shutting down. So I was wore Foley catheter for a long time.
Oh, gosh.
Which was great for concerts.
But, I can imagine. It's so uncomfortable.
But then I ended up just having to self-cath. For about 2 years, I had to self-cath. And I ended up on a news segment in Cincinnati.
What channel?
Channel 12. Liz Bonas put me on, and she's awesome. And on that segment, not with me, but through a video interview, she got a hold of Dr. Schimmel Shaw.
Oh, Dr. Shaw.
And he was on the show with us, but we weren't together.
Okay.
So I was in the studio.
Like
he was
different segments.
Same segment. They just did his video. And they came out to my house. So
it was COVID. You were sick.
It was during COVID,
and
too.
COVID, yeah, of course.
And so that was interesting. So after the interview and he watched it, he called Liz up and he said, can I have her information? So Liz Bonus gave him my information. He called me up. He called me up 2 days after it aired, and I was super sick, but I'll never forget the call. He introduced himself and said, I was on the thing with you. We didn't get to meet. I said, yeah. He said, I want to know why you're not registered at UC. And I said, well, I my insurance won't let me be dual listed, and this is where I was referred to. So he said, I can get you a liver. And he said, you're going to have to come off the list. At this point in time, I was already in hospice care, and the chaplain was coming once a week.
Oh, gosh.
And talking my family into my passing, and we had went to the funeral home to make my final arrangements, and we did it all. You know, coming off the list was going to be hard for me, but I wasn't getting a call. So I didn't know what to do, and he said, I can get you a liver. And I said, okay, and I held out hope, and hospice kept coming in, and
that would have been so scary, so incredibly scary. I bet for your family as well.
Oh, yeah, it was awful. So I did all the transfer to UC. They took most of my testing from the other facility, and I got to meet everybody, and I got to meet Dr. Shaw. And I just looked at him. I said, you said you can give me a liver, so when?
Yeah.
Because I'm in hospice care.
Let's set this time right now.
And the man looked at me, and I'll never forget it, and he said, Sherry, I'll have your liver in 30 days or less, and count on the less.
Oh, my God.
And I just looked at him, and I said, I don't have 30 days. And he said, I know. I walked out, and I was like, yeah, okay, so this is happening. Or not, right?
Right. You have to have, you know, you have the hope because you don't want your life to end, but it's still so very scary.
Hospice care was rough. Hospice care, they tried to keep me on morphine, and I was on an IV at my house.
Oh, wow.
My husband was amazing. My brother-in-law moved in.
Support system is invaluable.
Yes. He moved in with us. Took care of me and my husband. They did all my IV things and all the things that I couldn't do. So that was on a Monday. I went to UC and met everybody, and I was still off the list. And Tuesday is when they go to the table and decide who's going to be on the list.
Right, yeah. I got rejected twice.
Yeah.
But Dr. Shaw actually did my surgery as well. Amazing.
Oh, that is awesome. He's quite the human being. Tuesday, I got a call, and they said, you're back on the list.
That would have been a real sigh of relief.
So, okay. Tuesday, I'm back on the list. Wednesday, hospice comes, and the chaplain comes, and they tell me that I won't be here through the weekend to go ahead and call my family in. So I called my mom, and her and my daughter came over, and we were talking. This was Friday. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the phone rang, and I was like, you know, you got to answer the phone when you're on the list.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So it was Dr. Shaw. And he just asked me how I was doing, and I was like, fine. Hospice came on Wednesday. And he said, Sherry, I've got a liver for you.
Oh, my God.
And I had been called to the other facility for a liver, and I was turned down. So the whole ride home, which was an hour and a half ride, was silent.
Well,
so
for a lot of reasons.
Dr. Shaw said, I'm not going to be doing your surgery.
Oh.
So Dr. Quillen did my surgery.
Okay.
Dr. Shaw was out of town, so he took the time to call me.
That's amazing.
From out of town. And
you touched his life just as much as he touched yours.
If it wasn't for Liz Bonus from Channel 12, a news reporter of all people, just saving lives. They don't know that they're saving lives. So I woke up. It was Friday night. My surgery was October 30th on Saturday morning at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
They had to take me back into surgery. They let me in recovery for a while. They had to take me back into surgery.
Oh, wow.
Because my bile duct and the donor's bile duct, there was a mismatch in size, which is common. So, ERCP time, after my transplant for a whole year, I had maybe 4 or 5 ERCPs.
Yeah.
And I had an appointment with Dr. Quillen, and, you know, he's an amazing dude. And he just said, let me see your incision, right? I'm like, what are you wanting to look at your own artwork? What's going on here?
Peace symbol?
Right. I am hockey stick.
Hockey stick, okay.
Yeah. So, he said, yeah, I'm going to have to open that back up.
That's my worst fear.
And I said, okay, if it stops me from having to get the ERCPs, then let's do
it's
it.
It's worth it, I guess.
So I went in 2 years after my transplant for a biliary reconstruction. And no worries, ERCPs, yay!
That's amazing.
My liver's doing great.
We're out here and we're living.
We are.
And I love your story.
Yeah, we are.
I feel like you are so much hope. I love that you're so much out there.
I am.
And that you're spreading the word.
Definitely advocating.
I love it.
Organ donation is my passion because without it, neither one of us would be here.
Next, My Julie, Juliana, got to interview another Juliana. Spells exactly the same way. Very interesting.
And pronounces it the same way. Because I asked her, I was like, are you a Juliana or a Juliana? And she was like, I'm a Juliana. I'm like, yeah, me too. So there was this tall-ish, beautiful, blonde, smiley girl. And she was just, I don't know, she... little ray of sunshine, I would say, you know, just so positive about life.
Yeah.
So we sat down and we had this like really positive conversation, but it mostly focused around the relationship that she currently has with her donor's mom. And just recently we've dropped some additional blogs down. And one of the ones that we dropped that I authored is about my letter to the donor family for Stacy's donor family. Our donor family.
Our donor family.
It was inspired by my conversation with her. So she did write her letter to the donor family and the donor family reached out to her. So we'll
that
talk
gives me
about,
chills.
Yeah, we'll talk about this again, but, and you can look at the blog if you want to, but you can write your letter and you send it in through a third party, which is Donate Life and a few others will do that
it's
for you.
It's their choice on whether they want to contact you.
First of all, they don't even have to read the letter.
Right. They receive the letter.
They receive
it. And that's about it. The facilitation happens by that third party. And, you know, there is no contact unless the donor family wants to.
Right. They receive the letter. They can either read it or not, and they can respond or not. There's a lot of unknowns there, but writing the letter, you know, you're not doing it necessarily to hear back. So it was amazing to hear a person who not only did the mother reached out of the donor, but they have gotten so close and they have matching tattoos and they talk about the donor all the time. And I was thinking about how amazing it is that in this case, the donor's mom has chosen through Juliana's relationship, that relationship with each other, to honor her son. And it was just, I don't know, it was a lot.
As a organ recipient, that is something that I think is a shared emotion through all organ recipients, is that the best day of my life was the day I received that gift, because that allowed me to continue on my life. Without this liver, I would have died. And that's also likely the worst day of the donor's family. Yeah. So I want to express my joy, but I and all other recipients are very conscious of what that day means and all the different meanings that are in that day.
Yeah. So it was so awesome to hear how positive that relationship is and what that means to
her.
That's
really cool.
Yeah. So let's hear a little bit from Juliana and I talking about her experience with her donor's mom. I happen to be sitting here with Juliana Coates, who was a liver recipient in 2023, also from UC.
Yes.
And I asked her to come over and talk to us. So say hi.
Hi. Glad to be here. 2 years out now. I remember being here pre-transplant. This is my third picnic.
Wow. So yeah. You came before because you were on the list.
Yeah, I was.
Okay. And then so you're 2 years post.
Yes.
And how's it been going for you?
Everything's going pretty well. I'm very grateful for each day. Some days it kind of catches up with me because I run. Just taking advantage because you can't believe how good you feel now.
Well, yeah. So that's like a really good point. Your outlook post-transplant.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you don't want to say no to things because you've got this lease and new ability to do more. And so do you ever get run down?
I do. I probably factor in a day or two a week to rest. And some days are definitely slower than others, but it's good. I think after a couple years of really not being able to do a whole bunch, you feel the obligation to go and enjoy life.
Well, that's a really good word, the obligation, but it's good that you've got that balance where you're resting in between.
Yeah.
We have to listen to our bodies.
For sure.
You know, you can't get to a place where you're doing so much that you can't enjoy it again.
Absolutely.
So that's a big balance. So what kinds of things do you like to do?
I love hanging out with our youngest. We have one at home, and we love going to the parks and doing arts and crafts, and I love to travel. And
we love to travel, too.
Yeah.
Tell me about some places you've been since your transplant.
I've been to Alabama.
Okay.
We've been to Georgia.
And you say your youngest. How old is your youngest?
She's 10.
10.
So we're a blended family. And okay. The older two are 22 and 20 now, my stepkids. And then our 10-year-old we have together. So it's a really scary time during transplant. Sure. And you see the process of transplant goes over to whole family. The whole family fights during it. So
right.
It's a lot.
Yeah, and then I guess I understand, you know, being on the other side, it must be wonderful to be able to spend time with her.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel very lucky. And, you know, I've connected with my donor's family since.
Tell me more about that. That must be a very interesting experience.
Yeah. So I wrote them expecting not to hear because generally most people do not hear. It just seemed like everything just was meant to be with my transplant. I waited a while, but not long by most standards, just 8 weeks. UC's really fast.
They are fast.
By the time I got the call, I just couldn't believe it, and I thought maybe it wasn't a go, but when I went in that day, they said it was absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
And my donor's mom said my donor Graham was the same height and weight, and wow. I mean, he had so many similar likes, and she happened to be a retired nurse, so I think she has a different viewpoint of
sure.
life. We talk each day. We have matching tattoos. Whenever we sign off of a text aww. Message, we do 3 hearts, and we do a red, blue, and green for organ donations, blue and green,
yeah.
and then we love each other. So
that's amazing.
I would encourage anyone to write the letter. Because she hopes to hear from others. Graham was able to donate everything, and I'm the only one she's heard from.
Okay.
She really just wants to know, are they okay?
Yeah.
Was it
so
a
even
success?
If they don't reach back out to you, they can still get the letter? They can just...
Right.
Okay.
I sent the letter and heard back, I would say, within 6 months.
Wow, that's fast.
Yeah. One thing my donor's mom always says, please never feel guilty. This is an amazing gift that he was able to give.
Yeah.
And I'll text her sometimes like, Graham keeps on wanting chocolate chip cookies. My pants are tight. I just blame Graham.
Oh,
and,
that's amazing.
Yeah. And she's like, Graham wanted to travel and he didn't travel. So she's so thrilled for me that
yeah.
we're going on vacations and bringing him along.
I love that.
Yeah. I think he's a part of me. And
sure.
I feel lucky that, you know, everyone who met him, he had a huge friend base.
Oh.
So I was at his 1 year celebration of life, which was really oh. incredible. And yeah, I know. So
it's just amazing. You know, I wish more people understood the gift of donation.
Yeah. I feel very grateful. It's just incredible that what he was able to give and do. And
are you allowed to tell us just the first name of your donor?
Yeah. His name was Graham.
Juliana and Graham. I'm talking
yeah.
to Juliana and Graham.
Absolutely.
So another person that Stacy was able to interview was Doug. And one of the things that kept coming up as sort of a theme with a couple of the guys that we both separately interviewed was the ignoring thing, where I know something is wrong, but I don't necessarily want to find out what's going on, so I'm just not going to go. And it sounds silly, but it's true. And I'm not trying to be sexist in any way, or ageist, but I do think that men tend to not go to the doctor probably more often than women, it seems.
I can tell you, my husband, for sure, he's like, it'll just go away.
Right.
There's a pain, but it'll just go away. And what's weird? A lot of the time it does.
A lot of these things are cyclic in nature, where you have moments that are really bad, but then it gets slightly better and then they get bad again. But what struck me in your interview with Doug was he was so honest about, hey, they were telling me this. And I was like, well, let me just go back to work and like see if I can, if it'll go away. I know we're laughing about this, but Matt brought it up too. Again, I'm not trying to say it's just men. There are women that do this too. But it's interesting how sometimes our fear around not wanting to know, because once you tell me, I have to accept it. And if you don't tell me, I can just keep going. So I think it's a little bit deeper than the more it might just go away. But I think that it's interesting. And maybe in season two, we can dive into that a little bit more since we're going to have more people in here. Maybe we ask that question consistently with people to see if there's something there. But anyway, Stacy talked to Doug and he talks about that. So did Matt.
Doug definitely made me giggle a little bit. He was very candid and very open and honest.
And funny. He was funny.
Right. And like I said, this is a shared journey that we all have. But there are differences.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, let's take a listen to Doug.
Doug is a liver recipient, and he received his liver in 2022. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am just turned 65 years old. I was raised in Indiana, used to live there. Trying to convince myself that I need to slow down and retire, and it's not working very well.
No, I can see you've got a lot of energy about
you.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
So how did things start to go downhill?
Probably about 5 years ago, I was working and I started feeling really bad. I felt bad enough that I actually called 911 on myself and ended up being transported to the hospital. They weren't real sure, but they think I had a liver attack. Referred me to see my physician afterwards, and then they've referred me to a surgeon about having a gallbladder removed. In the surgery, we went in to take the gallbladder out, and he said that my liver was in such bad shape that he was afraid to take the gallbladder out because he was afraid if he nicked my liver or something, it would be too far damaged to be able to save me, and I just bleed out right there on the operating table.
Wow.
So he referred me to a liver specialist. When I went to, I was not impressed with. And of course, being a stupid Indiana farm boy that I was, I just blew it off and thought it'll be fine.
Oh, my God.
About 2 or 3 years later, then, I volunteered firefighter. I was out on a fire run, and I started feeling kind of sick. And I told one of the EMTs that was there, and next thing I knew, I'm in an ambulance being transported to the hospital, and I got there.
How much time passed between you blowing it off and actually feeling the symptoms?
Probably 2 or 3 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, not a drinker, not a smoker, you know, pretty much a typical boring
person.
And
active if you're a volunteer, yeah.
Right. They ran some tests. They told me your liver's in pretty bad shape. They referred me to a gastro doctor.
Yes, me too.
So they did a CT scan, and the doctor says, I see things, but I want to do an MRI. Of course, you know, I'm too dumb to think anything's wrong. They do the MRI. I don't hear anything back for about a week. On a Friday night, I get a phone call from her saying, I am so sorry. We found a tumor on your liver.
Oh, my.
So they referred me to the UC, to the transplant team. Like within 2 weeks, I was up there talking to them. I didn't know what to expect. I thought we were just going to go up and explore options.
Yeah.
They said, no, you need a transplant. You're in end-stage liver failure. Man, with a tumor, too, then that's not helping matters. My wife went with me, thank goodness, because I was in no shape to drive by the time that was over with. So they said, we're going to start doing tests for you to do a transplant. So we're going to need a little blood from you before we leave.
A little.
I think it was 13 tubes later.
Oh, my God. My record's 21.
Oh, well, okay.
21.
Well, so then it was, you know, a whole meeting with any kind of doctor you could think of, anything from anesthesia to heart.
The diagnostic testings are just crazy. You do.
Yeah.
You meet with all sorts of doctors.
Yeah. And the one that surprised me was the dentist. I had to go get clearance from a dentist. And, of course, being the dumb, stupid, hard-headed Indiana farm boy that I was, I had not been to the dentist in years. 7 extractions and 6 cavities later.
Oh, my God.
But that was the hardest part, getting that taken care of. Finally, after everything was taken care of, they called me up and said, you're on the list. Go off with your life, but don't go too far either.
Yeah, did they ever give you any indication how needy you are for a liver based on what's called a MELD score?
Right, yeah.
Did you have one?
Do you
remember?
And I can't remember. I think like 17 maybe, something like that.
That's high.
Yeah.
And still walking around,
still walking
going
around,
to work.
That first meeting, they told me you need to resign, retire, whatever, and your job now is to get ready
stay
for a
alive.
Transplant. Stay alive. They said, get a hold of Social Security, see if they can help you out. Luckily, I had just turned 63, and I was able.
Oh, that's amazing.
I was able to get that, and then the disability also. Yeah, they called me, put me on the list, and probably about a week later, which just blows my mind.
Yeah,
they called me
that's
up and
fast.
Said, you're being considered for one. Said, there's a couple other people that were looking at too. Well, they called me back a couple hours later and said that the other person needed it worse than me, and I said, that's fine. You know,
yeah.
Probably within a week, they called again and said, get up here. I said, it's not the best liver, but if I have to take medicines, I'm going to take a medicine the rest of my life anyhow. What's another?
Exactly.
But we got up there. I was prepped. I was wheeled down to the pre-op. Doctor sticks her head around the corner and says, we're sorry.
Oh, no.
Says, we put eyes on the liver, and it's not for you. It's no good.
Oh, God.
So back home again. And probably within 3 or 4 days, they called again and said, it's yours. Get up here now.
Let's go through it again.
Yeah. Well, this time it was good.
That's amazing, Doug.
Yeah.
So we've now shared with you a couple snippets of the people that we were able to interview at the picnic. And I hope that this experience at the picnic is one of many experiences that Stacy and I get to have. It was definitely life-changing to be in a space with so many people. I want to reiterate that not having to say certain words, not having to qualify and explain yourself is amazing.
Yeah.
just being around, being around people where there was so much said just with glances and looks and hugs. It was really a profound experience. Yeah.
It was beautiful for me. The acceptance, it shocked me at first to be in a situation with people that knew exactly. I didn't fully expect that. And I love that that's what happened.
Yeah. There's a picture of all of us from the picnic. And we were chatting about that a little bit, about how it just felt, it's hard to describe. It felt really good to be in the group. I would have liked to have never been part of that group, because I would have liked my sister not have to go through this. But now that we have, and we have this community, it feels really good.
It does. It really does. I am so grateful this community exists for me to be a part of.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a wrap for this episode of Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. If you'd like to stay close to the journey or eventually connect with others navigating similar paths, join us at life-expectancy.com. Membership is free, and we'll be opening up new ways to share, learn, and thrive together soon. Special thanks to Ryan Brunn, whose original music scores our episode with depth, and to our producer, Kenzie, who brings it all to life. And if you're a music person like us, search Life Expectancy Podcast Season 1 on Spotify, or visit the site to find our companion playlist and all of our socials. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.